this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 86 of Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest for the podcast is Camille Perry, whose debut novel, The Assistants, is scheduled for publication tomorrow, May 3rd, 2016. While it may be true that just about the only thing that dies in The Assistants is innocence, it is a crime story. And like many who find themselves having committed a crime, Camille's protagonist, Tina Fontana, can't control the fallout. And therein lies the story. Here's Camille Perry.
Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and our guest today is Camille Perry, whose first novel, The Assistants, will be published on May 3rd. Welcome, Camille.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Speaking of Mysteries usually speaks to writers who have written novels where people have died gruesome deaths. And it seems like in The Assistants, the only thing that dies is innocence.
Yeah, I like the sound of that. That's exactly right.
And
yeah, there are no grisly murders in The Assistants, but there is a crime at the heart.
Right. It is very much a crime novel, and the unintended consequences of a crime that seemed innocent in its first incarnation, if crime can be innocent, it both gets wound up and unravels at the same time. And I think that as we go through talking about it, that might make sense. However, maybe not.
Makes sense to me.
Tell me, though, about the inspiration for The Assistants.
I was working as an assistant to the editor-in-chief of Esquire magazine. This was back in 2009. And I had a lot of student loan debt. One day I was doing my boss's expenses, which is one of my responsibilities, as most assistants have. They have to do their boss's expenses. And I remembered that my student loan bill was due. So I pulled up my my account to pay my bill, and something just in my brain clicked when I saw those two windows open side by side on my computer. And I thought, if only I weren't an honest person. But then I thought, well, that's a great idea for a novel. And it all started from there.
Well, Tina Fontana, your protagonist, it's not quite the same experience, but her receiving the funds by which she pays off her debt starts as a bit of an accident. And it can you talk about what went through Tina's mind when she did that, and how she intended it to be? What was she thinking?
What was she thinking? It could have been the subtitle. What was she thinking? Sure. Yeah. Tina.
Oh, no, no. The subtitle. I thought of a subtitle. It should be The Assistants. The Road to Hell is Paved with Good Intentions.
That's good. That does make it sound like more of a mystery too. More of a crime novel. You know, Tina is she's a good person. She's a person with a moral code and has values. So I wanted her to really struggle with the decision. Because I think most of us in real life we're not so quick to steal or do something dishonest or something that we know we'll feel guilty about or that our moral code tells us is wrong. So I really wanted this to be sort of vague in the sense that it would almost be the equivalent of if the ATM spit too much money out to you and you just like had this money in hand and maybe you didn't even count it until you got home. So you're in the privacy of your own home and you realize, oh my goodness, I have this stack of money that doesn't really belong to me. But here I am at home. I got away with it. Is anyone going to notice that it's gone? Can you really put a face to anyone being hurt by me keeping this money that would be a life changer for me? I mean, if it were the case, I wouldn't so much feel bad for Chase Bank, you know, if that had happened to me. And there was a book a while ago that came out, and I read it around the time where I was plotting out The Assistants. It was called A Simple Plan. don't know if you remember this.
Oh, yeah.
And he just, there's a downed plane, and he just literally finds a bag of money, and he's a pretty honest guy, and he just takes it home, and everything unravels from there. So I wanted that similar situation where, like, any given person in this situation would, if not decide to go ahead and keep the money, would definitely consider it. So that's really where, so in Tina's mind, I think she was just thinking all the things that any one of us would think if given that opportunity.
Well, I think you did a really good job of creating this world of underpaid, overeducated, ambitious young women. And for the most part, assistants really still are women. And you enumerated these three rules, and that is all important men have assistants. Men still rule the world. Or you said men rule the world still.
Yeah.
And there is enough money. There is so much money. So this is kind of an environment that is ripe for this sort of moral ambiguity that Tina is facing. It seems like a very unequal world.
Yeah. Well, I hope that the book will, I hope people will have different reactions to it, and maybe if they're discussing in their readers group or just among friends, I wonder how people will stand on, did Tina, how wrong was what she did? And I hope it fosters the sort of conversations that talk about fairness in a time right now where we're facing such vast inequality. Just class inequality in our country is like unprecedented since, you know, the Great Depression. I mean, this is the story of our time. I feel like particularly my generation, this is the defining characteristic of Gen X and the millennials, particularly the millennials. I'm sort of on the cusp of Gen X and millennial. But I think this is a defining characteristic of our time. This is what they will be writing about us in the history books, 30 years from now. So I wanted the book to speak to that for sure, this ambiguity of what is fair when we're living in a time when a CEO's secretary is paying more in taxes than him and he's a billionaire. How do we even talk about fairness and equality and justice when this is the setup that we're starting from?
Especially, I think, in the case of Tina and the other people that sort of fall into this widening gyre of duplicity, is that they did what they were supposed to do. I think that's sort of the added layer of unfairness, that these women went to school, probably started college before the Great Recession, when it seemed like a good idea at the time to take on tens of thousands of dollars in debt to get an education. And then they're spit out of these really excellent schools like NYU. And oops, you know, those good jobs are not there. And you're going to, if you're lucky, get a position for $40,000 a year where you're going to live in a small apartment and you're going to barely be able to pay off your, you know, a loan that 15, 20 years before would have been what your mortgage would have been on your first house.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really gotten so much worse than it was even 20 years ago. So it's enough to make you want to, I mean, no one gets murdered in this book, but it's enough to make you want to murder someone, you know?
Well, there is, I found in this book, in the relationships that Tina builds, first with Emily, and then you did some great, without stereotyping, you really got sort of to the heart of the different characters that you encounter in a large corporation, even sort of a sophisticated media company, that there is the nerdy girl who's in IT, and there's the woman who wears sweaters with animals on them in HR or accounting, that these people populate, they populate a corporation, you interact with them, and Tina sees them at first through their stereotypes and then begins to understand. So that there's something sort of subversive through the whole book about identity, who these people are and who they really are, who they seem to be and whom they really are.
Well, that's good to hear. I'm glad that you felt there was. I try to not. It's, you know, it's sometimes difficult when you're trying to write a fun, entertaining book to not stereotype, especially when you're trying to kind of place different. You want it to be representative of different people and different people's experiences. So, you know, Emily and Ginger, like they're coming to this from a very different sort of place than Tina and the other, you know, the other characters as well. So I did want various backgrounds to be represented, but still in a realistic way. So I think a lot of the characters are sort of composites of people who I encountered in my time working for a corporation as an assistant. And they're just the different types of, especially the sort of female friendships that can form in a workplace, in a work environment. Because I think that sort of setup lends itself to people who maybe wouldn't necessarily be friends in the outside world or work friends. So I felt like that's interesting and right, as you know, that's good ground to go into as a writer. I think it's fun to character build that way. I wanted this to have a strong female friendship element to it. I wanted the, you know, it's a women's novel. I wanted it to have strong female characters, and I didn't want them tearing each other down. I wanted them to join together, to band together in this way that was entertaining but also empowering.
Well, you touched on something. I found it very much a caper novel, but yeah. sort of a caper novel with a dark side. And
definitely.
And yeah. You know, there are certainly the humor situations Tina finds herself in, like, you know, looks around and goes, you know, a little bit like the Talking Heads song, you know, how did I get here? But as you pointed out, she is at her core a good person. She muscles through or finesses her way through this moral ambiguity and this, you know, sort of moral relativism that I think without going into a spoiler, it has a very surprising ending. And what it made me think of as she faced this inevitability in her career was something that a lot of history of business and has said that there's a little bit of larceny at the core of every business. You know, something probably wasn't quite kosher, you know, that helped people get their start. You know, they tweaked a bit just to get going.
Yeah, sure.
And it seems like that's something that might have happened with Tina.
Definitely, yeah. I think that's definitely true. And you know, part of that too is I didn't want to make Robert a straight up villain or a straight up evil man. You know, this capitalist, this Rupert Murdoch type, this billionaire, one percenter. It would, like, Robert should be. You know, he should, I mean, Tina likes him. She admires him. She wants to make him proud. So I wanted that to add a little bit of complexity. Like, I didn't want it to be just too easy to try to take this guy down, you know, or make him an emblem of all that's wrong with our capitalist unequal society. So I wanted him to be a little bit nuanced as a character as well.
Well, I think you accomplished that. I mean, I think that, towards the end of the book, you sort of see how it's going to play out. Tina reaches this sort of crisis, and I thought she went in a kind of an interesting direction. pulled herself together, you know, found her gumption and went forward. And I think part of it had to do with, as you described, this female friendships that she had built, and to not go in a particular direction would hurt a lot of people.
Yeah.
And she didn't want to do that.
I think, you know, she's struggling as the caper unfolds. It spins out of Tina's control. So she keeps trying to pull it back until, you know, a certain point at which she realizes she needs, it can't be pulled back. And you can't, it's beyond her control. It cannot be pulled back. So she has to take initiative in pushing it forward in the direction that she feels is the right direction to push it forward. Speaking very, very obtusely so as not to ruin anything for your listeners, but that's how I see it anyway.
You know, going into the world of an assistant to a powerful person, and I think when your characters were pulling together an event, I thought the horse trading that went on is pretty accurate, especially in the media world. These are, I call it power by association. They don't make any money, these women, like Tina. However, they wield an enormous amount of power by proxy. And that's another element of the story, you know, another way that Tina and these other women grew and learned how to play the game, even though they didn't have all the tools to play it.
Yeah. Throughout writing this, I often wrote a line in my margin, which is a favorite, which is Audre Lorde, and it's "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house." But in this case, I wanted these women to use the master's tools, use the master's tools exactly, to dismantle the master's house. So essentially what Tina and her fellow assistants do is use some of what she has learned from Robert to kind of try to triumph at the end.
Well, it seems like they take it apart and what they put back together is for themselves, but different.
Yeah. In the way of, you know, 9 to 5, which is, I feel like, the perfect comparison. If anyone who hasn't, you know, anyone who has seen the movie 9 to 5 and enjoyed it and is looking for a updated, you know, book version of that type of revenge fantasy, you know, that's, I think they'll love this book because that's really at the heart of it, is these women who take something apart and put it back together in a way that suits them better.
Well, we should also say that, you know, as I was reading this book, it seemed like a very good blueprint, but I almost feel there should be a disclaimer, like you have in advertisers, of, you know, created by a professional writer. Don't try this at home.
Yeah, do not try this at home. Do not try this at home. It's funny that you mentioned that because in writing it, you know, going through different edits and fact checks and this and that, plausibility was an issue. Like, I wanted to write this in a way. I mean, look, I was an assistant, and the way I wrote this was like, okay, if I actually wanted to steal from my boss, if I really wanted to embezzle using Keeney, using his expense account, how would I do it? You know, and this is how I would have actually done it. And this is how, when I did research, I found embezzlement is actually rampant among not only assistants, but especially bookkeepers and these other kind of mid-level, mostly women who have embezzled money. And of course, they all do get caught because it is very hard to get away with unless you really are careful. So, you know, they do what Tina, you know, Tina does this, and she, this is not a spoiler, she immediately gets caught. I mean, it's not like, I mean, she gets caught by Emily, but, you know, in a sense, the way that this breaks down is her initial action is immediately, when Margie Fisher has lunch with Tina and Emily, she, you know, she says, what were you thinking? You know, so of course it spins out of control in this other way, into this other direction, and this caper happens. But the crime that Tina initially commits in the opening chapter, she gets caught right away. And I think if anyone did try to use this book as a blueprint for embezzling money from their boss, they would probably be caught pretty quickly, as they probably should.
Well, you have to say that because, of course, stealing is wrong. You know, sometimes it's hard to say that. Is it stealing or is it just a justifiable redistribution of wealth? You know,
redistribution of wealth. Yeah, I mean that's a whole other story.
So yeah. You were an assistant, and then you went off into the world of, you were assistant to an editor-in-chief of a magazine. You continued on working in magazines. Now you are a full-time novelist. And the interesting part of that and the discussion that we had before we started the interview was the changing nature of a full-time novelist, and you're doing things like podcasts. Speaking of Mysteries is not the only one you've done, and you are writing essays. So I want you to talk about, you know, was this something that you expected to happen? You know, you have that thrill of having your novel accepted and the sort of the highs and lows of writing it, the wonder of turning it in and, you know, working on it some more and seeing it in print. And then, oh, by the way, you're not done.
Yeah, it's funny because I've covered books for magazines and I've worked in media. So you would think I would have an idea of what to expect. But I have to say I've really been sort of surprised with, first of all, it's been great. The response, the book hasn't even out yet, and the response has been so wonderful. And people have reached out to have me on their podcast, to have, you know, to do Q&As, to have me write personal essays for their blog or magazine or whatever it is. So that's incredible. But I really was not prepared. I wasn't prepared. You don't know when you sit down and you write a book, and even if the book sells, and even if you know it's going to get published, there's no formula to it, and there's really no way to know if it's going to resonate with people or not. And I, you know, even now, without the book being out and not knowing how it's going to sell or anything like that, it's hard for me to even say. But based on the interest that's happened in the last few weeks, it's been amazing. It's been amazing and very, very surprising to me.
Well, I think reading it hits a chord. I know so many young people, and it seems to be young women, have these outsized debts. You know, they worked very hard in high school. They went to really good colleges, and then they came out, and there wasn't a lot there for them. And
yeah.
And you're right. Men rule the world still, and you know, maybe that will change in November.
Who knows?
But still, yeah. it's something you know. It's something that women, at least in the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st century, it's like, what? We're still only making, you know, 79 cents to every dollar a man makes, and you know, really, you know, is this really
yeah.
still happening? I can sort of see a lot of book clubs reading the assistants book clubs. Of women, and maybe not taking it as a blueprint to steal from their corporations, but as kind of a way of looking at their expectations.
Yeah, and I think feeling less alone is a very powerful thing. And what I think is interesting about debt is that we don't talk about it, or at least I know I didn't. I always felt very ashamed of my debt, even though it wasn't debt that I created by spending lavishly, going on fancy vacations. I mean, none of that. No, I mean, my debt was student debt, which should, you know, be sort of pure, but it's still, it still holds you back. You know, it still changes certain decisions that you make after years of having it, you know, wrapped around your neck. Like, what kind of apartment can I afford? Will I ever be able to buy my own home? Can I afford to even say yes to brunch this week that rent is due? You know, so it's there. And I think, first off, I think one great thing that's come out of young women reading this book is maybe they'll think more about, well, huh, why is it that I'm in this situation when I really have played by the rules and I really have done everything that I was told and I did, you know, made good decisions and got into the best college that I could and worked hard and now here I am. What's wrong with the system that's created this predicament for me? And maybe they, one, won't feel like it's their fault, and two, will take a more active role in the political situation and the, you know, the government situation that's created this. And three, recognize that it's not all their own fault. And I think that's really powerful, to realize that you are among many friends who are in the same situation. And if you could kind of band together in a way that's politically useful and having your voice heard, I mean, that's like the best thing in the world that could come out of this novel. You know,
so you're not,
that would be like a dream.
You're not just a novelist, but you are now the architect of a movement.
I am the real life Tina Fontana.
Without the crime.
I'm not. But I did intend to write a socially conscious novel. I wanted it to be, number one, a fun, fast-paced read, but underneath all of that, you know, part of the heart of it is, I did want it to have a socially conscious element to it, so I can't deny that.
Without beating people over the head and saying, this is going to be a socially conscious novel, because I think that you could sort of hear the covers slapping closed under those circumstances.
Oh, yeah, I know. I should be careful when I use words like that. But I think if you look at the book and if you start reading the book, that's not how it's going to hit you, you know? You've read it, so I can talk about it this way to you. It's really what, you know, that's what's in between the pages. It's not the main attraction.
Thank you, Camille, so much for joining us on Speaking of Mysteries. And I encourage, as I said, you know, you can live without the murder, as it were. But there's a nice, juicy crime here.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It was really fun to talk to you.
I'm excited about the next few episodes of Speaking of Mysteries, when we'll be talking to Steve Hamilton about his standalone novel, The Second Life of Nick Mason, Martin Walker about Fatal Pursuit, his new Inspector Bruno mystery, and R.J. Coretto about his debut mystery, Death on the Sapphire. This is Nancy Clare. Thanks again for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.